Hello, and thank you for joining Hashtag No Limits. I am your host, Shelley Kino, and Hashtag No Limits is about people who society has placed limits upon, but who have busted through those limits. Ophelia says in Hamlet, we know who we are, but not who we will be. And I believe that to be 100% true, and that there is no better example of that than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. For those who don't know, the caterpillar literally dissolves into its cells and then reforms in the cocoon. And then, as if that isn't difficult enough, it has to struggle in order for its wings to be strong enough to fly to take it wherever it wants to go. Now, my guest today is I'm very interested in her story because she was diagnosed with inattentive ADHD, which is not a diagnosis that most people hear about. And so I am excited for her to tell us her story and to really get into what her life was like and is like now with the diagnosis. So then, Cynthia, oh my gosh, I'm tongue-tied today. Thank you for joining me. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Good. Awesome. So tell us a little bit about yourself, more than what I just said.
Yeah, well, what struck me as you were talking was about changing from a caterpillar into a butterfly. And when I got diagnosed, what the doctor said to me is, I envy you. You get to have a whole new life. And I certainly didn't feel that way as I was getting diagnosed with ADHD. And I didn't know, I knew some about it because my son had been diagnosed. But what I didn't know too, I've seen the caterpillar switch into the butterfly, and it might happen in less than 30 days. But actually, for someone with ADHD to learn to create a new life for themselves, I think I've read, and my experience was, it can take 3 to 5 years. It's a process. It's not an overnight magical thing. But when I learned, I was 49 years old, and at the time it was my son's pediatrician that diagnosed me. I thought I was the only adult in the U.S. that knew they had ADHD. So it was a very lonely experience. And then I found a book. It was the first book ever written about adults with ADHD. And in the back, they mentioned a woman in Bellingham. And she told me about the first conference that was being held for adults with ADHD. I went to that in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Dr. Halliwell was there, Terry Matlin was there, Sari Solden was there. They had been known about their ADHD maybe for no more than 3 years. So it was just the very beginning of adults starting to know they had ADHD. And when I came back from that conference, I decided to start a support group for people with ADHD. Adults. It didn't work out too well trying to have a group of mixed people. Some of them were successful in their lives and wanted to know how to do better. Some of them were on medical coupons because their ADHD and maybe co-occurring conditions enabled them to be labeled needing SSI. So the range is really different. And we always hear that about people with ADHD, that if you know one, you know one. There's so much range. And I started the support group. And I guess I went on from there. I ran that support group. It became a nonprofit, and we ran it for 15 years called ADD Resources. And during that time, we had national conferences. They were all located in Seattle. But through that process, we had Dr. Dodson come, Dr. Halliwell came several times, Dr. Daniel Lehman, Kathleen Nadeau. So I get to know all these people. And it's surprising how many of them are still active in the field. And when I talk to them, they're so passionate, they say they're going to die doing this. And I guess I qualify for that too. So it's a love and it's a commitment. And actually, I did leave ADHD I retired from the nonprofit and I trained to be a coach. And I retired from everything when I was 67. But during COVID, just for fun, I was going to write a memoir for my children. I thought, you know, we like to have something new to do, and learning how to write better and learning and I don't know with other ADD families, but in ours, we never really got to talk about what our lives were like. We just had to deal with what was going on the day to day. So I wrote the memoir just for my children, but then it evolved. So it became a book about my life with inattentive ADHD. I hired a professional to help me. He didn't help so much with the writing as with the structure of the story. He said a book like this should be a hero's journey, which I think ties into what you're talking about. But you have a problem after a problem after a problem. And that's what my life had been like. And then, you know, you come out of your chrysalis and you're wonderful. So that's what my book is about. It's called Living with Inattentive ADHD. And it's a memoir, but also a self-help book, because I explain how I improved myself before there were coaches, before there was a lot of knowledge about ADHD. And I think the things that helped me would still help other people.
Yeah, absolutely. And so one of the things that I like to try to do when I have authors on is to offer the guest, the audience, an opportunity to win a copy of the book. And so I'm glad you just mentioned your book today. So for those of you who are watching, the way that you can be entered in to win this book is to subscribe to the YouTube channel, share this episode either on YouTube or on Facebook, because you can watch it in both places, and then comment on this thread, either again on YouTube or Facebook. And you have 48 hours to do that, because I know not everybody who watches can watch it live. So I like to give the people watching in the replay an opportunity as well. And for this one, you probably are going to have a little bit more than 48 hours, because I'm actually going to be at a conference for the rest of this week. So I may not get a chance to check everything before Saturday or Sunday. But I really appreciate your book and the fact that you share your journey, because your journey was so incredibly unique. I mean, you're talking about 20, 25 years ago that you were diagnosed as an adult, and the special ed law in the school systems was only about 20 or 25 years old at the time. And and so what was your life like going through school? Because if I'm doing the math right, you were at the end of your schooling when the law came into play. Is that about right?
Well, I don't know. I graduated from high school in 1961, and I graduated from college in 1965.
Okay, then I did the math wrong.
what year was the ADA? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I was talking about IDEA. Was 1975.
Ah, okay. But also, I wasn't well educated, and with my son that did have inattentive ADHD, we sent him to a private school, and someone was asking about, did we get accommodations for him? And it was like the question blew me away, because I said I never even thought to ask the school about that. I never shared his diagnosis with anyone. And I'm sure he's 48 years old now. So I'm sure he would have, you know, been in that era where I could have accessed that law. But I hope parents today are better educated than I was at the time, because I wasn't ashamed of it, but I just didn't think there was help available beyond what we were trying to do at home.
Right. And sometimes, even though someone has a diagnosis, the people tend to figure things out on their own and figure out the ways that they learn best and the ways that, you know, so they make their own accommodations and, they manage it a little bit differently, even without having to get an IEP. If he's just turning 40, did you say he was just turning 48 or he just did?
Yes.
Then yeah. Because I'm a little bit older than that, but the law has been in play most of my life of being in school. So, But again, you know, it.
Well, the other day we interviewed a parent and her child was diagnosed in the second grade and he's now in college. And she said when her son got diagnosed, she stopped working full time and her son became her project. Mm. So I don't like to hear that it took so much time, but I think it is helpful for parents not to have a lot of children when they have a child that has ADHD or co-occurring conditions. But she made a special effort to talk with each teacher or write something out for each teacher about how their child performed best in the classroom. And what she found is that teacher communicating with the parent was really helpful, and that maybe just relying on the IEP to do the whole thing is not a helpful. Parents need to be more involved than that, you know, and, right. and we know so much happens through having relationships and getting to know each other and not making a combative relationship, but we're working together to help our child.
Exactly. And that is exactly what I do as a master IEP coach, is I try to help everyone at the table be collaborative with one another so that we can help this child reach their fullest potential. And so thanks for letting me talk about what I do besides doing this. And it is unfortunate that many, many times parents don't reach out to me or school districts don't reach out to me until it's an adversarial relationship with a family. Mm. And it is so important to, I teach teachers about listening to parents, because parents are going to do the research. They are going to, you know, they know what the child was like before a teacher came into play, and they'll be with that child after that teacher is gone. And so they know the learning strategies, they know different techniques. And we
I think it's a two-way street of respect, you know, respect mm-hmm. both ways. Was something I wanted to say, and now I forgot what it was. But
I'm sorry.
No, that's the way it goes.
It might come back to you. I was a special education teacher full time before I became an IEP coach, and so I always had a great deal of respect for the parents that I worked with. And my book, which normally sits right over my shoulder, but is not there right now for some reason, and that's what my book is about, is the stories of families who are living that life every day. I don't live that life every day. I'm just blessed to be part of it. And so I was very honored to be able to share 9 different stories, of a family like yours, that, you know, how you approach things, how you think about things, you know, how you get around and do things in some instances is different than mine, but that doesn't make it wrong or bad or less. It's just different.
Well, and I think for my husband and I, was with a different child, but we were really struggling. And my husband's a physician and I'm a trained social worker. And so, you know, you get into this mindset as we can do it ourselves. We know what we need to do. But we did call in an outside person and it really helped the situation. So sometimes that outside opinion is what you need to move forward.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I said in the beginning, the inattentive ADHD, I feel like there's very little known about that specifically. And I don't even honestly know what the statistics are of people diagnosed with the inattentive ADHD. Would you happen to know those?
Yeah, I know that. Well, there are 18 symptoms for ADHD, and that's called the combined type if you have a mixture of all 18. And I've talked to some women who do have all 18. And so starting out, people can have a different number of symptoms of ADHD. But if your primary symptoms are in the inattentive category instead of in the hyperactive impulsive category, then I think you'd consider yourself inattentive. But it's not like your symptoms are only in the inattentive type, because I have risk-taking, which is more the hyperactive impulsive. But I think my affect or the way I come across is more the way an inattentive person would come across. If you have met someone who's really high energy, who is physically restless in their body, you would more think that they had the hyperactive, the combined type of ADHD. So I interviewed women that had the combined type. For some of them, if I asked one question, they could have talked the whole hour. And they would have finished the interview like that was just a part of their day. But if I had attempted something like that, it would have wiped me out. So there's a difference in the energy level. There's a difference, I think, in the volume of ideas flowing through their mind, because they can, one thing makes them think of another thing and thinks of another thing very quickly and with a lot of volume. I mean, I can think of things, but I think it's more like at the 33 RPM and they're at the 78 RPM. That's the only way I can really characterize it, because the combined type has a lot of the same symptoms, making mistakes, not following instructions, disliking mental effort, easily distracted from tasks, not listening. A lot of the symptoms that they're the same, you know, they have them, but they don't, we don't have some of what they have. And so when I asked someone in the field, I said, which is worse, inattentive or combined type? They said combined type because they had more symptoms. But I think inattentive type is almost as harmful because it's been going undiagnosed. When people say, oh, my image of ADHD was the hyperactive little white boy. I mean, now it's the hyperactive little boy, because we hear that black children, black boys are sometimes, there's a fear they're getting overdiagnosed. I can't talk to that. But that image, I think, is actually who does get diagnosed. And it's harmful. For me, yesterday, I just was starting to get angry. When I got diagnosed, it was called ADHD, if you didn't have the physical hyperactivity. So there were two names for it, ADHD for those of us that didn't have the physical hyperactivity, and the ADHD with the H in it for the people that had the physical hyperactivity. But then they decided, oh, those people without the physical hyperactivity, oh, they have hyperactive brains, so let's call everyone ADHD. So those of us that don't have physical hyperactivity, we're still called ADHD. Mm-hmm. And I think it feeds into the myth that you need that physical hyperactivity. I mean, who goes around thinking you have a hyperactivity brain? You say you have a hyperactivity body. You know, I just think it's leading, even though we hope more people are getting diagnosed with the inattentive type, I think just that name still perpetuates the belief that it's the people with physical hyperactivity. And the thing I found diagnosing women that had the combined type, so they would have that physical hyperactivity, they also did not get diagnosed because of cultural expectations that girls aren't physically hyperactive. And so they would suppress their physical hyperactivity. One girl said, I learned to get up to do chores in the room or to sharpen my pencil, to go out to the bathroom, to wiggle my foot quietly under my desk. One woman said, I bit the inside of my cheek so I wouldn't move. So there were such strong cultural messages on the girls who have that combined type that they didn't get diagnosed either. And I started out this second nonprofit, the Inattentive ADHD Coalition, to say we wanted children with inattentive type to get diagnosed before age 8 and adults who went for help to get readily and correctly diagnosed. Because again, when they go for help, particularly the women, people weren't recognizing it. They were saying, oh, that sounds like depression. Oh, maybe that's anxiety. And while they might have had those conditions and the medications for those conditions helped them, the women I talked to said it helped somewhat, but there was still something else. There was still something else. And so until they had that final diagnosis of their ADHD and could put it all together, I don't know, but Dr. Dodson said that it was taking people 6 medications, wrong, you know, medications for depression or anxiety before someone, the light bulb went on and said, oh, maybe we should be thinking about ADHD. And the saddest cases for me is when I talk with these 25 women, many of them were in therapy for years during their life, and the therapist did not recognize it. You know, so there's a great under education of the therapists and the physicians needing to catch up of how it presents in adults. Actually, I got interviewed by a woman called Dr. Margaret. And even in our conversation, she was saying, oh, I had clients, I think, you know, she's starting to think that she didn't know. She didn't recognize. Right. And when I went through social work school, we were taught that if a client is late for an appointment, you look on that as treatment to resistance.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, all of us people with ADHD that wanted help so much and we were late for appointments, we were thought to be resistant to treatment.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That's so sad. And you know, it's so unfortunate, but it's so common that we don't recognize different skills, different abilities or different disabilities that, you know, someone who has been trained, I'm thinking about teachers, our general education teachers, they get such minimal training on special education. And then the training that they get is very overarching of what special education is and how it might work in a school, but they don't get a lot of education on how to teach or how to differentiate, but yet our law requires them to be in their classrooms all the time. And, you know, it kind of sounds like maybe social workers are getting similar lack of training because so many social workers seem like they're not recognizing when someone has ADD or ADHD.
I think there is a lot for people to learn, and maybe it shouldn't all be put on their training, but to be somehow for them to be aware that these are things you need to go out and learn about on your own. You know, that there is a class you can read or a book you can take. And that's why I hope my book would give even therapists insight on how this feels, how it looks. Sometimes it can just be watching a video. The women I interviewed, so many of them figured out about their ADHD from watching TikTok or Instagram. So there's lots of ways. I'd say out of interviewing 25 women, 8 of them, that was what happened. During COVID, without the structure of having to go to work, and some people, they said that's how they manage their lives, is being so busy. You know, that they had to stay on task. They were under pressure. You know, it created anxiety in them, but that's what helped them, is to be so busy. And when COVID happened and they stayed home, their lives fell apart. And I guess they ended up watching their computer screen and the light bulb went on.
Wow. That's incredible. So at least now we know that there's good things about TikTok and reels and all that stuff. It's helping people find out, you know, some insight into themselves. What were your biggest struggles during school that now that you know you have this ADHD that you can go, oh, that's probably what that was?
I don't use this as an excuse, but I have a terrible memory for what happened in my childhood. And even I write, going back to a high school reunion is very stressful because people will come up to me and remember me and I don't remember them, or they'll tell me things that we did together and I don't recognize it. But one thing I remember is in high school, a neighbor would walk by. We walked to school together. It was like a mile away. She would walk by, and I never was ready when she came. I knew when she was coming. I never was ready. It was always 5 minutes more, whatever, that was a big issue. The other thing, I don't know if, I just say it for myself, but sometimes I think we think we're better than we were. Or, well, anyway, I was a high school cheerleader, and we voted for who was going to be the captain of the cheerleaders. I thought I would be the one selected, and I didn't get a single vote. And so, I think, I don't know if this is we talk about we have low self-esteem, but on the other hand, I think sometimes we have false high self-esteem, that we don't perceive ourselves the way other people are perceiving ourselves. It's that variability, because sometimes we could be, we can, you know, over-respond to it, of someone looking at us the wrong way or saying the wrong thing to us. But I just think we're a mixture of extremes in a way. There's a woman in Australia, she talks about the spikiness. And I think that really applies to us, that we're really good at some things and not good at other things, and we can't figure it out. And Dr. Hallowell said that leads to the anxiety, because you don't know when you can count on yourself. You don't know what the conditions are that make you perform well. So when I interviewed for college, I don't know, my score was like 460 or something the first year when I took junior SATs. And the next year, it was almost 200 points higher. I never thought twice about it. But when I went to interview at a college, the admissions counselor asked me about it. And she said, you know, why was that? Were you sick that day? And I had no explanation, you know, so... and I remember trying to write a paper and how I kept writing the first sentence over and over again. I just couldn't get started. I couldn't. And I would crunch it up and throw it in the wastebasket. So I started to save a lot of paper once I could learn to type. And you know, you realize you could go back and change it later. It just, the flow, I could get in the flow. But before that, my writing was too slow to keep up with my thoughts. It was just a bad struggle. In college, we did research papers, and I would take notes on a 3x5 card. And because I had a challenge handwriting, I would figure out a code system. I'd say, well, the number one refers to this book, you know, and so I put a number one and the page number or whatever. And then I would have all these note cards that I'd be trying to arrange into topics. And somehow I would lose my concept of what number went with what book. So by the time I was writing the paper with the footnotes, it was all made up. You know, I wasn't sure I was accurate on anything because my system, I forgot what it was. You know, so I remember those struggles more than something when I was a much younger child.
Right. And I just wonder, I mean, when I hear the word inattentive, to me, that just speaks to that you have a problem staying focused and, you know, that you don't catch a lot of the things that are going on. And so I just wonder if it's not necessarily a memory issue that you don't remember those things as much as you just didn't catch them when they were happening, when you were going through school and going through high school. Am I understanding the inattentive diagnosis correctly?
I don't know that everyone with ADHD has a poor memory. but I do. Even now, if I read something on the screen and I need to use it when I go to the other screen because it's telling me how to change something, I'd have to print it out, because just going that far, I've lost confidence that I've remembered it correctly or that the words got it. So I rely on looking at things, reading things, instead of relying on my memory. And I wondered at some point when I read this article about how people remember, that I wasn't willing to do those things. You know, to take flashcards and look at them over and over again, it sounded so boring and tedious. So I think sometimes the skills to develop a better memory, I didn't want to do. So I wonder if I could have had a better memory, but beyond being built not to have a good memory, I made it worse by telling myself I don't have a good memory and not bothering to do those things. You know, or even where they say create a mnemonic or create a picture of all the things you need to remember. It just seemed that in itself seemed like a complicated step to do.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the inattentiveness is your mind wandering away, not even being aware that your mind is wandering away. You're not engaged with what the teacher's saying. So you might come back in and be off place. You don't know where you should be. The class has read on to the next page and you didn't know that. You might be bothering your neighbor to ask them, what are we supposed to do now? What did she say? You've been visiting Hawaii in your mind, or you've been noticing something out the window. Then you don't listen to the instructions, so you might not complete the paperwork. You might not do the second side. Just a lot of things of, well, I listened to someone the other day, and Russell Barkley and Sam Goldstein thinks that the inattentive type of ADHD in the future will be called slow cognitive tempo. We're not quick on the uptake. Like if people tell jokes, I'll say, I don't get it. You know, everyone else is laughing and I'm saying, I don't get it. So I don't know if it's hard to say if I have a brain that processes more slowly than other people, because you don't know how other people, you know, how they're processing things, but that's what they think. Slow, and there used to be two children in a video where one had the inattentive type and one child was just neurotypical. And visually, you could just see the difference.
Really?
You know, oh, yes. And I talked to a woman at Duke. She's so confident. She said, and I have this confidence too, that she could walk into a classroom and within a few minutes point out the two or three children that needed an evaluation.
Really? Wow.
And so
that is not a skill I have.
That's my hope. Have you tried it? You study each child.
I feel as though
go in and observe for an hour. Go in and observe for an hour.
Yeah, I mean, I do see when I'm in classrooms, because I still sub occasionally. And so when I am in classrooms, there are some students that I think, oh, they might need a little something extra, or, you know, because as a substitute, you don't usually get the list of, oh, these students have IEPs or 504s or medical needs or whatever. You just get the class list. And, you know, so I don't always know, but I mean, I will be 100% transparent. When I took my test for special education, the lowest score that I received was on recognizing all the different disabilities by their characteristics. And I'm actually kind of okay with that, because I think that helped me to see my students as a student first and not as whatever it was that made them eligible for special education.
Well, that's good. Well, this is off topic, but that's all right. I was a teacher for 2 years of emotionally disturbed blind children. That's why I went on to be trained as a social worker. But the first week, there were like 30 children in this residential facility, plus the staff. I thought I would never learn their names. And I went home every night just focused on the children's blindness, you know, thinking about it, being overwhelmed by it. And then after like 2 weeks, when I knew everyone's name, they were just children. I didn't notice the blindness. And, you know, it wasn't, it was an element, but it wasn't the child.
Right.
And I think the same, you know, what you're describing there. But what our hope is that teachers know normal childhood development and, you know, the, what do you call that curve? The bell-shaped curve.
The bell curve,
so
yeah.
They could recognize the, they could tell the children that are off the bell-shaped curve, that are on the end of the bell-shaped curve. That's what we're saying. Those are the children they should say, let's learn more about this child and what their challenges are. Because I think it's Ross Green that says, every child wants to be successful. And if they're not being successful, something's getting in their way.
Right. Yeah. And the other thing that I really appreciate from him is that the most people think that children will behave if they want to behave. But he says children will behave if they can. So I do very much appreciate that in him.
As a parent, that's kind of hard to swallow. We had a son that got in trouble with the law, so it's kind of hard to think that he couldn't have controlled that, but maybe it's true.
Well, and you did say, is this the same son who has ADD?
Should I tell you more about our organization? Because what happened? Well, this son got diagnosed with bipolar disorder.
Okay.
And that things changed. While you're a teenager, things changed a lot. And he straightened his life out. So he's married and has children. But teenage years can be a new ball of wax, I guess I should say. But I wanted to talk about the Inattentive ADHD Coalition. We started it because of Inattentive being underdiagnosed. But in the 2 years that I've been out back in the field and reading people on social media and, you know, attending webinars and stuff, I realize there's a whole group of children that don't get diagnosed. You know, I think, as I said, the only ones getting diagnosed are the ones that are physically hyperactive. That's still the mindset. They're the children that are causing problems in the classroom. So it's not up yet, but our new focus is going to be that all children need to be screened for ADHD before they finish the second grade. We found out, we know that about 10% of the population has ADHD, and we now know that if it's not diagnosed, they have their life expectancy is 12 years less than someone without ADHD. 12 years.
Wow.
Because of suicides, because of accidents, because of poor health. We don't take care of ourselves. If we're diabetic, we can't follow a diet. If we don't know how to regulate ourselves, we're more at risk for early death. And now, the other day, they came out with research from Israel that people with ADHD that are untreated, don't take medication, they have almost a threefold risk of developing dementia. If they take medication, there is no difference. No difference. But I haven't read the article except, you know, the abstract. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what kind of medicine, how often you had to be taking the medicine, but it's leading them to think that some of the medications for ADHD could help people who have dementia. Well, anyway, I haven't taken medicine for years, but the other day I emailed my doctor to ask him if I could go back on something because of this research. If it's going to help me to not become more demented than I already am, you know, I want that help.
Absolutely. That's incredible information and something and that I have not heard about.
Yes, go look it up. Early death. And a website I would recommend to people for valid, credible information was screened or evaluated by people all over the world is ADHDevidence.org. And a lot of it's amazing in the studies like Israel and Sweden and Denmark, they have national health registries. So when they do research, they can draw on 100,000 people to say, we've looked at, you know, their life and they have this diagnosis and they, whatever. It's very, very clear. But the other thing our organization is stressing is that when a child is diagnosed with ADHD, screening should be recommended to the parents because we now know that there's a 50% likelihood that one or both parents of a child with ADD also has ADHD. And when I look back on my parenting before I knew about my ADHD, and even afterwards because I was so focused on myself, and I didn't, well, anyway, that's going off a different track. We had gone to see a therapist because we were having struggles with our children, two children, and he recommended behavior modification. So I created a beautiful program, you know, points for this, no points for that, you know, treats. So I was doing the program with my two children. It was going really well. And one morning I woke up and forgot about it. And so when I went back to the therapist, he said, well, how's the behavior modification going? I had no idea what he was talking about. You know, I said, oh, it was going well. I don't know why I stopped. So these are the kind of challenges a parent can have if they have their undiagnosed ADHD. Plus, I think the emotional regulation, it's harder to keep yourself calm. It's harder to not blurt out something that maybe you shouldn't say. It's there's a need for children with ADHD to have parents that know about their ADHD. And so those two things, we want all children to be screened so we can find it early. And we want parents to know to get screened when their child has ADHD.
Yeah, that's incredible. And so one of the things I know that your research you talked about earlier is you talked to 25 different women.
I don't do research.
Oh, okay. So you were talking to 25 different women. Is there a difference? What am I trying to say? Are women or girls underdiagnosed? And based on what I'm seeing on your website, I think I know the answer to this.
Oh, yes. Yes, they are. What happens now is over the years, it started out like 3 to 9 times more boys were diagnosed for every girl. And the boys were getting diagnosed by age 7. The girls were getting diagnosed maybe when they were 12 years old. Already, a lot of damage has happened to their self-esteem. But they were saying it was like, and then it got down to 3 to 1, 3 boys to 1 girl. Well, now with the adults and all these women figuring out they have inattentive ADHD from watching TikTok or, you know, whatever they learn, the ratio in adults is 1 to 1. So we don't know what the ratio is in children, but we know historically there's been a bias towards diagnosing the boys. Mm-hmm. And we know that girls, whether they have combined type or inattentive type, have been underdiagnosed. But there are also boys that have the inattentive type, and they've gone undiagnosed too.
Yeah, and I have a feeling that the, so, as I mentioned,
I'm surprised you didn't know all this. I'm happy you're learning this.
Yeah, me too. And I love, this is the kind of stuff that I love to learn about.
The knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and the other thing to know is children with, if you have ADHD, your likelihood of having a co-occurring condition is higher.
Right.
The OCD, the bipolar, the Tourette's, the autism, even asthma, sleep disorders. So for me, yeah. So for, I tell people, I was lucky. I didn't develop depression. I didn't develop anxiety from going undiagnosed. And so I think my story is helpful in the sense, because if those things exist, people often jump to say, oh, that's the reason. Oh, that's the reason. Oh, you had a impoverished childhood, or you were raised by a single parent, or, you know, all these other reasons they could give it. But my, I had I had a two-parent family. My dad earned a good income. My mother stayed home. I had structure. I had all the right things, but I still had problems. And so it's harder to say, oh, these other things caused the problems, because you could rule those out. The problems I had were because of undiagnosed ADHD.
Right. Exactly. And I absolutely, I didn't know the exact number ratio, but I did think that girls were underdiagnosed. But I just think in general, the inattentive part of ADHD is, or ADD, is underdiagnosed. And it was something that I had heard as a special education major. But again, I don't feel like our general education teachers get that same sort of training. And so they get students in their classroom and they hear that the student has ADD or ADHD, and they assume a certain characteristic or set of characteristics, and then they treat the students as such. And that's not necessarily what the student needs, or it is appropriate. And what you just said a second ago about the comorbidity of different other disabilities that, you know, a lot of times in a setting, and, you know, because I'm a teacher and that's my background, that, you know, that's where I always think about, and that's the setting where kids are the most away from their home, is that we want to just say, oh, okay, this is all an autistic, under the autism umbrella. So all these characteristics that you're showing, so we're going to treat this with the approach from autism. But really, if they had an approach from ADHD or executive functioning deficits, then what they were doing with the student would likely be different, and the student would probably be more successful.
The common thing it said is the boys get diagnosed more often, or the hyperactive impulsive combined type gets diagnosed, because they're disruptive in the classroom. Right. Now, I hate to hear that, because what I like to believe, and why we work to educate, is if you don't know what to look for, you don't see it. And I think inattentive type can be seen if teachers are educated about what to look for. When we interview the women, we always, or even adults who got diagnosed late in life, we ask them, could someone have recognized it earlier? And about 100% of them say yes. And this is what I was doing, that they could have recognized me if they knew what to look for. And the other thing that I heard from Dr. Orrin Mason is that teachers, you know, they're overwhelmed when the school year starts, and they're trying to kind of figure out which children are going to be the problem children. but the child with inattentive is not a problem. And later on, the teacher has moved on. She's no longer trying to notice who should I be referring for help. So he gave that proviso too, that maybe they should check back in a few months later to see, you know, do we have children in this classroom who have variable performance, who don't seem to be paying attention, who seem bright but are not living up to what we think their potential is. So have new ways of looking at the children and finding them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do like what you said about testing every child, although I can hear school districts and parents and, you know, just saying there's no way we can do all of that.
Well, what I'm really become a fan of ChatGPT and IA. So my vision is that medical offices can see which children in their practice are 7 years old. They will automatically send a screening tool out to the parents. The screening tool comes back and IA evaluates it and says they alert the physician to the ones that are to the score indicates maybe there's a problem. And then the parent is the one to ask the teacher, you know, if the ones that get screened that, oh, this might be high risk, then the parents ask the teacher to fill out the screen for that child. So there aren't that many children. It will be the reduced number.
Right. Okay. That makes, yeah.
And I guess AI is involved in the whole process. Yeah. So the parent is asking the teacher to fill it out. And only after the parent has been told there's a concern, your child might have something we need to evaluate for.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, that would definitely.
And meanwhile, if the teachers are learning more about how these conditions present. And the other thing that happens, and this is happening more in the UK and the Australia, I think, is the neurodiversity movement and the focus on creating inclusive classrooms and inclusive workplaces. So getting away from the concept there's only one way that's acceptable to show us your knowledge.
Right.
Or what someone was saying, there's only one way to show your knowledge. And, you know, that getting up to walk around the classroom is going to be appropriate. Someone said to get a F on a paper because you turned it in late.
Oh, you know, I hate that.
Some of those things to just open people's minds up as to how they can offer variety so that different ways of learning can be accommodated. It might not just be through the IEP because you're going to have children in the classroom who haven't been diagnosed. So just offer these different approaches as part of how you teach.
Yeah, exactly.
And it will help everyone.
Absolutely. How many times have we found something that we said, oh, we're going to make this accommodation for someone in the disability community, and then it ended up being beneficial to a huge majority of the population?
Oh, yeah, like the slope sidewalks.
Uh-huh.
You know, people on skateboards, people in wheelchairs, people riding their bikes, blind people. I think it's easier not to have to step off a curb. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when we had the first conference for ADHD, there were a lot of things that made it difficult for us to get around. And afterwards, we put these suggestions into the university. And we thought, these are things that will help everyone.
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. Well, Cynthia, I so much appreciate you being here with me today and sharing so much information about inattentive ADHD, because I do feel that it is not mentioned enough. It is very overlooked. It is very misunderstood. And I was so excited to find you. I don't even remember how I found you exactly, but I'm so glad that I did. I think it was LinkedIn. And I just want to give you one last opportunity. We're almost to the hour mark, so I want to make sure that you have shared everything that you wanted to share.
Well, I was going to share my book cover, but maybe you have a picture of it.
I think
I can go.
I thought I had it up a little bit ago. Okay.
Yeah, it's okay. I don't know where I have a box of books, but I know it's hiding. Well, anyway, it's available. It's available at Amazon, and if you buy it there, I'd love a review. But otherwise, I'm trying to get people to buy it from their local bookstore or the library, because I've read about Amazon being so monopolistic.
Let me see. I had it up when we first started. Where did I put it? Okay.
Oh, it's under living. Yeah, this one. Living.
Okay.
Under this one, living with inattentive ADHD.
Yep, my right computer there. Has decided to go to sleep. There we go. Yeah, living with inattentive ADHD, climbing the circular staircase of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And like I said, for those of you who are watching live or are watching in the replay, make sure that you like this channel on YouTube. If you're not already a subscriber, do that. And then share it on YouTube or Facebook and comment on this particular episode, and you will be entered in to win one of these books, a copy of this book. Oh my goodness.
Oh, so the one thing I wanted to say is, even if you don't have the inattentive type of ADHD, what my book does is if family members read it, because even when my sister read it, she said, I never realized this about what your issue, you know, and she had grandchildren with it. So I think if you have trouble explaining your condition to your family, this book might help with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is some of what my book does as well. It gives that insight because for some reason, people are more willing to share when it's going to be on paper than if they're doing it face to face.
Well, I think some of that's just people are shy about public speaking.
Yeah. Probably. And nobody likes to talk about the things that they struggle with. You know, we don't want to talk about and bring other people down or have other people feel sorry for us when it's just our life and it is what it is. So again, Cynthia, thank you so much for being here today and for joining me. I very much appreciated our conversation. I look forward to following you continually and seeing what other wonderful things you are up to. For everyone else, please join me next week, same time, same place. I will be having Sam Young from the Young Scholars Academy on with me, and we will be talking about all the great things that are happening at the Young Scholars Academy. Thanks, everyone. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelly Kino, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelly Kino, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelly Kino is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shellykino.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shellykino.com, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y-K-E-N-O-W.